Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. It sounded like I was talking to myself. I am your host, Rob Watson. I am your host, Rob Watson. And tonight we are going to be talking about a couple of things. It's been quite a week in Washington, not particularly LGBT oriented, but simply hugely dramatic things have been happening with the conviction of Michael Cohen. And that does have throwback on every group that has been under the Trump oppression for the last 2 years. It is a signal of a potential movement on justice being done, or at least the airing of the back rooms of what has been happening with the Trump administration, which has oppressed so many, from immigrants to transgender communities to LGBT in general, et cetera. So we'll be asking Brody about that, since he is one of the most connected people I know on the Washington scene. But also tonight, we are going to be talking about restrictions that have come down this week and recently from a couple of social media platforms, including Tumblr and Facebook. And Tumblr has restricted anything that is not suitable for work content, and a lot of porn-oriented pages that were on there are either no longer or going to be taken down, and that is causing quite a stir. And then Facebook had some changes in its policy having to do with sexual solicitation, and the verbiage that they've used, from sexual preference and different ways they've described it, have people pretty concerned. So we're going to talk to Brody about that. But also we have a special guest, John Paul Bremer, who is a New York-based writer and advice columnist from Oklahoma. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Washington Post, Slate, NBC, and more. And he is in the process of writing a book. But we have him tonight, and we will be getting commentary from him on the subject. So we're looking forward to hearing what he has to say. But first, I'm going to bring on my good friend and co-host, Brody Levesque. Good evening and welcome, Brody.
Good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listeners and to JP, who is going to be waiting for a couple of minutes while we run through what has been probably one of the most dynamically interesting weeks that I have ever seen as a political reporter in 3 decades I've been doing this in Washington. The Trump administration is in complete disarray. I should note a little bit earlier this evening, I was speaking to a couple of sources in the White House who indicated that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is now one of the ones being considered to replace outgoing White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly. As you know, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Nick Ayers, had turned the job down yesterday, which sent the president into orbit, from what I understand, in the West Wing, and made life a little bit unfortunate for those that happened to be within range of the presidential anger. And, of course, this was also, as we were looking at the prison sentence for his one-time personal attorney, Michael Cohen, and then we watched him literally have a meltdown in front of us in the press corps, in the Oval Office, over his wall, with Speaker Designate Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, and then the Senate Minority Leader, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. I was more impressed with Representative Pelosi because she did something that even those of us in the press haven't done, and that she stood him down. Of course, that's now generated a whole bunch of interesting memes. I think the best ones I've seen, there was a photograph taken by the Associated Press of her and Schumer walking out of the entrance to the West Wing. And the best one was behind them, Pelosi's putting on dark glasses and the entire building's going up in flames, which I thought was great. on a more serious note, however, I've been speaking with constitutional scholars. We've been looking at what's going on. The president of the United States is completely and totally at a disconnect. And this makes it a very difficult and dangerous situation for the American government. The other part of it is, judging from the little temper tantrum, as Schumer basically categorized it, and I think fairly so, we already can see how the incoming Democratic House and the Republican Senate will probably dealing with the president. We are looking at a likely shutdown of the federal government if the president holds true to his threats and doesn't sign the bipartisan agreed continuing resolutions that have already been agreed upon both in the Senate and the House. So we're kind of waiting to see if he's going to hold hold up to that. We honestly don't know. It's also a mix of other problems, too. In an absolute rebuke to the president, the Senate passed a resolution this afternoon which named Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as directly responsible for the murder of U.S.-based Washington Post columnist and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It went on to the House. On top of that, we got even more news firing up about roughly 5 hours ago. It was as a direct result of the probe into the president's personal attorney. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington and the special prosecutor have now indicated that the president's inaugural committee and its spending is also now under criminal investigation by prosecutors. The ongoing investigation in New York will also continue. Michael Cohen, as you know, was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He's not due to report until March 6th. Indications we're getting from the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York is there's still some more cooperation that they're expecting from him. And there's a very strong likelihood that Cohen will be testifying in front of at least two House committees, one on intelligence and the judiciary, before he goes to prison, which, of course, is going to make things probably even more complicated for the president. At this point, besides the shutdown, we're expecting the president to spend about 16 days at his estate in Florida, Mar-a-Lago, over the holidays from December 21st to January 6th. However, as we know from experience with him, that probably isn't about, going to stop him from getting on his phone and doing a Twitter routine. It was also disclosed by my colleagues at NBC News this evening that Trump was, in fact, the third person in the room in August of 2015 when his lawyer, Michael Cohen, and the publisher of the National Enquirer, who their parent company just made a deal with federal prosecutors, had discussed how the National Enquirer, specifically the publisher David Pecker, could help counter negative stories about Trump's extramarital relationships with women. That's now been confirmed. Besides NBC News, the Washington Post also has confirmed it. Also today, the Senate has voted to withdraw U.S. military support for the Saudi war in Yemen, which is the first time that we can think of that they've actually invoked their part of the War Powers Act, and they will be limiting the president in that. It's been kind of a ongoing thing. Trump had a rather extraordinary interview with Fox News' Harris Faulkner today, and he was referring to Michael Cohen's sentencing yesterday, and he told the Fox News reporter, and I'm quoting the president, "They put that on there to embarrass me. They put those charges, those two charges, on to embarrass me." And of course, he was referring to the hush money payments that were made to porn actress Stormy Daniels and, of course, Playboy playmate Karen McDougal. The problem that senior political observers and attorneys are beginning to see with the president is that he doesn't understand that those are, in fact, criminal charges because they did, in fact, influence a federal campaign. The president's been tweeting and maintaining that these were private affairs, but they're not. Now, of course, to muddy the waters even more, Marina Butanina, who is a operative, we've now found out, of Putin ally Alexander Torshin, was also directly working to influence top leadership of the National Rifle Association, including NRA fundraisers. She's pleaded guilty that she was engaged in a conspiracy against the NRA. From what we can determine, part of this was also to influence the 2016 election cycle. So as you can see, it's just been this never-ending parade for the last few days, Rob.
Wow. Thank you for that incredible account, Brody. That I'm literally like picking my jaw up off the floor on about half the things that you kind of revealed in that in the statements you just made. You got me right up the top with Jared Kushner being a likely replacement of John Kelly. I mean, that first of all, part of the thing that boggles my mind about that is this is a guy who couldn't even get security clearance for a big portion of Trump's first year in office. Correct?
That is correct. Kushner has since passed the security clearance, and he does have it now. But it becomes extremely problematic, as is everything to do with that family in connection with the office of the President of the United States. And I'm talking about the presidency itself now. There is just too much interwoven between business, private, public. It's just become an absolute swamp, literally, to coin a phrase, of conflicting interests and probably illegal actions. It was revealed that Kushner was making telephone calls to private ones to the Crown Prince, basically advising him as the Khashoggi matter was on, it was revealing itself. As you know, President and the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, have basically given the Saudi government a pass on what happened to Jamal. However, I think it's just for appearance sakes alone and impropriety to have Kushner sit there and be talking to the Crown Prince while all of this other political drama is going on. And then, of course, to suggest him for chief of staff is, at the end of the day, it's more than just nepotism. A lot of people have argued that, but I think it goes deeper than that. I covered five different administrations, and the complexities of the West Wing and how it works and what goes on there, you have to have some separation. You have to have some delineation, and you have to have some basic understanding of the machinations of not only the government, but also the decor and traditions and, the right way that the office of the President of the United States needs to function. And which, again, in the 2.5 years, and I will say this fairly, the American people elected themselves a reality television star, and that is pretty much what you now have, at least as far as the executive branch goes, is you have a reality television show, and it's a pretty grim one at that.
Yeah, that, very, very scary. So, Brody, thank you again for all that. The Cohen conviction was was a big shocker, and just the information coming out has made many people remember, well, many people who remember Watergate remember it, and many people who were not around for Watergate start relating to what that was like. I mean, I've had numerous conversations this week about how impactful this is. But I want to move on to our other subjects of tonight. What is going on with Tumblr and Facebook? Let's set it up so we can bring our guests on.
About a year ago, Tumblr was acquired by a unit of Verizon Corporation. And at the time of the acquisition and the takeover, they immediately started to go after the adult theme and adult content. And the problem with Tumblr is it's more or less, and JP will probably be able to kind of have a little bit more of, I think, an educated outlook on this. But my take on it was Tumblr was the Wild Wild West. It was the, it was a place where it was kind of a everything goes atmosphere in the blogosphere. The principal problem with the pornography was also the fact that you had a lot of child pornography. I have spoken to folks at the Department of Justice. I've spoken to friends at the FBI, and I talked to friends with Britain's MI5, New Scotland Yard, and then I called Interpol. And there was a problem with it, and they were trying to get the platform, I think, under control. And then I think the decision was made corporately. They just threw their hands up and said, you know what, we're just going to completely eliminate it. And therein lies the problem, because not everything that they're going to be eliminating is, in fact, porn, at least not in a, in a puritanical sense.
Right.
And that's, this is the biggest problem with this, and this is really why I wanted JP on, is that I think that we're going to be seeing targeting that's going to negatively impact the trans community, the gay community, the lesbian community, the queer kids, artists in particular, and Freedom. One of the artists I actually know, he's a young man from Phoenix, Arizona. His name is Brennan McGill. He's a gay queer artist, and he, for the last 3 or 4 years, over 3,500 posts and a lot of effort, had built up a really decent blog, and it's all about his artwork. Unfortunately, some of his artwork is, in fact, not safe for work. But, you know, that didn't seem to matter. And then on the tail of this, Facebook, which had done some revisions to its community standards back in October, that had kind of gone a little bit under the radar screen. But once this thing with Tumblr hit, Facebook then decided to introduce really problematic revisions to the community standards in terms of language. Now, the Facebook representative that I spoke to said that, well, this was a direct result of trying to also curtail human trafficking and things of that nature. But the problem with that is that it doesn't accurately reflect, again, if you're within the gay, the queer, the trans community things. Let me read to you what was said. I spoke with basically the chief spokesperson for Facebook, Ritachika Budahara, and this is what she told me. She said that Facebook is in the process of hiring more content reviewers and is using computer algorithms to help it take down what she deemed problematic content. However, she noted that Facebook would also be using an independent set of panels to determine, and these are humanized instead of algorithms or AI, what should be done about certain problematic, posts and what should or shouldn't be taken down into the new revisions. Now, I asked her specifically about the LGBTQI community, and this is what she said. Quote, stating one's sexual preference or partner preference does not violate our policies around sexual solicitation. Sexual solicitation, as we have defined it in our community standards, also requires offering or asking to engage in a sexual act. And then she acknowledged that there would probably be a little, you know, hate directed and shading thrown at the company. And she went on, quote, I don't think everyone's going to be happy with where we're going to be drawing the line. I just, then she noted, just saying I'm gay and I'm a bottom looking for a top wouldn't necessarily come down or get deleted under the policy. But then she said, if someone were to say, quote, I'm a bottom looking for a top, call me, then that would come down under the policy. And the problem is that it kind of flips into a different dynamic there at that point, because what exactly determines what's solicitation and what's not? And again, I'd like JP to weigh in on that. And finally, before we bring JP on, I'd like to add this last thing. I spoke to Sarah Grossman, who runs Matthew's Place, which is an online safe zone for LGBTQI youth, sponsored by the Matthew Shepherd Foundation in Denver. And this is what Sarah said. It's absurd, especially when you consider that for LGBTQI youth that live in rural areas, online is the only place where they may be able to discuss things, figure things out for themselves. If Facebook is now going to censor their language, how are they supposed to be able to learn, explore, or understand themselves, their sexuality, or their experiences? And with that, let's talk to JP.
Right. And with that, I would like to welcome JP to the show. JP, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No, we really appreciate you being here. So I think you heard what Brody said about what was going on with Tumblr and Facebook. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's certainly a lot going on here. Just like Brody, one thing that really stuck out to me was when he mentioned the AI, because this is something that I've been following for a while, both at NBC News and over at Condé Nast, where I'm at now, which is that there's actually sort of a race going on right now to make AI less homophobic. It's actually a huge problem where a lot of LGBT content across a lot of social media platforms like YouTube and Twitter gets automatically censored or automatically put as a lower priority in terms of, like, whenever you're looking for content, what shows up for the next video to watch or tweets that we might think you'd like. LGBT stuff tends to get cut out of those things because it's automatically assumed by algorithm to be inappropriate or to be mature. And that sort of touches on biases that people have had against LGBT people for, I don't even know how long, probably decades. But the thing is that AI collects information from human biases. So if enough people flag something as inappropriate and it says nothing other than, like, I am bisexual, I'm a man who likes men, etc., AI will tend to automatically categorize that as too mature for a lot of people to see. So when the Tumblr thing happened, a lot of LGBT content creators who don't even deal with specifically not safe for work content were rightfully afraid, because they're saying any crackdown that happens in this vein is going to censor LGBT art, LGBT conversations. It happened on Twitter where people who tried to come out just by saying, I am this or I am that, gay, bisexual, trans, etc., this was seen as the same thing as using the word as a pejorative. So it was lumped in with someone on Twitter saying, you're gay, you're an F slur, et cetera. And I think a lot of those fears have already been substantiated. In the reporting I did on it, I talked to some people who said that their posts have already started being flagged as inappropriate. I interviewed one artist a trans artist whose work they showed me, and it was just mostly like kind of cutesy coming out art. mostly saying, like, hey, right, it's okay to be trans, etc. And it was being flagged already. So there's every reason to be worried on that front. In fact, this is such a problem that GLAAD has actually partnered with a few people to try to make AI more accepting. And the reason that the window is closing is because AI built on itself. And if you can't fix the core of the matter, it'll just keep learning from that same direction. So it's hard to teach AI to be less homophobic, more accepting as you go along. Our window is actually narrowing every single day. And so things like this Tumblr thing that has come out and said, we're going to be relying on AI to figure out what posts don't meet our standards, that's cause for concern to begin with.
Right. JP, I want to define, just for our listeners who may not understand, because what you said was really intriguing and important, but AI is artificial intelligence, and it's
right.
that means that, to your point, it teaches itself. So it takes in information,
right,
assesses and literally self changes as it goes based on how it's been set up. It literally is thinking for itself.
Right. It's
which is
algorithmic.
Is Yeah, and the source of many science fiction movies are the past. We are now there.
But, what's funny is that... Go ahead. Oh, no, I was just thinking that what's funny is when I say AI, people tend to think of a, like, I don't know, an evil robot or something like Sophia the robot who can talk and has emotions and stuff like that. But it's really, you know, man-made programs that rely on data algorithms. So obviously everything humans make is going to have a lot of errors and biases and mistakes in it, and that's clearly being reflected in what a lot of people are reporting on Tumblr right now.
Yeah, this is what I'm being told as well.
Didn't YouTube do something like this about a year or two ago that caused a lot of the LGBT videos to essentially be censored?
Yeah, they were actually demonetized. So there were a lot of LGBT creators who make things for profit, a lot of huge, big names, like Tyler Oakley, for example, people with millions of subscribers who make content for the LGBT community that has nothing to do with explicit content, were finding that their videos were being demonetized automatically by an algorithm because it was being flagged for inappropriate content. And so YouTube had to sort of step in and be like, hey, we're sorry about that, it's fixed. But it really is a good example of just how faulty these algorithms can be and how human biases can infiltrate and negatively impact LGBT content creators.
I wanted to follow up with that for a second because Rob and I had a YouTube creator who also, and his husband, who also create on the Instagram platform. He's known as the shirtless violinist, Matthew Olivashevsky. And Matt had a problem on YouTube, JP, and this was 6 months ago, where his boyfriend had just simply kissed him, and the video got flagged. And then in the process of that, now I'm also being told by a few of these other folks, and you are, I'm a political reporter, so I would tend to trust your expertise a lot more than my own, but I'm being told that this is still an ongoing problem, and that particularly with the trans community, my trans friends are telling me, especially the ones that do creative content, and as you said, not even close to being, you know, explicit in any, you know, frame or sense of, you know, the word, they're still experiencing this problem. And I guess my question to you is, as we're starting to look at this, is it just seems to me, and I may be wrong here, but social media seems to be intentionally, for whatever reason, edging us into just kind of our own lane and a very narrow one at that. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. And it sort of goes into something I'd like to bring up, which is really part and parcel to all this, which is the passing of Falsa Sexta, which is the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act and the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. It passed earlier this year. And it was really pitched as an attempt to curb sex trafficking online. And it sort of ties in with this Tumblr thing because, you know, on its face, it could be seen as, oh, okay, Tumblr's trying to curb child pornography on his website, which, you know, obviously we all know that that's a problem and that's something that needs to be taken care of. But just like with Tumblr, these bills were sort of Trojan horses where they said, oh, yeah, it's to fight sex trafficking. But really the people who are feeling the most impact are people who censors tend to affect the most. So LGBT people, sex workers, especially queer sex workers. And it's really all part of one wave of people trying to determine what you can and can't see online. I think that's really where all of this started. And we're still seeing the effects of it. I mean, sex workers are reporting the immediate effects of the bills. They were sort of saying that their work was being lumped in with sort of trafficking, with child pornography, everything they were doing, which had nothing to do with what the bills were claiming to be against. It was sort of put on the same level, which I think we're seeing on Tumblr as well. So I've seen a lot of people, I mean, again, anytime there's a crackdown on sex work or what kind of content gets shows on a website. LGBT people are typically the first ones to feel the brunt of that, not only because LGBT people, especially trans people, tend to do sex work more often, but also because LGBT identities are so stigmatized and so sexualized by cis straight people that it tends to be the case that just saying you are gay is viewed as an inherently sexualized thing, an inherently sexualized statement. I mean, I'm seeing debates on Twitter right now. It was a young person who was like 15 saying, hey, I think I'm gay, and everyone blew up because they're like, you're just a child. How do you know you're gay? You're sexualizing yourself. You're a kid. Those are the kind of biases, that's the kind of panic that sets in and leads things like this to happen.
Right.
Yeah, it's what you brought up is really both interesting and important. I kind of want to take it to a broader picture of all of the social media platforms. You know, Facebook, in the election of Barack Obama against Mitt Romney, Facebook played a really important conduit for a lot of the material for those of us who write for LGBT issues. And, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of the pages got a lot of that content out to large audiences in a very effective way. And then they kind of pulled back the rug on that, where pages were no longer, when they published, the content wasn't getting out to people the way that it had been. I know as a writer, I was seeing in particular things that I wrote about transgender people would suddenly drop off a cliff in terms of how many people were actually being allowed to read what I had written. Are we at a point where these algorithms are going to severely handicap not just civil rights, but the intellectual growth of society? I mean, isn't that how new ideas and things that people haven't considered before get exposed to it, where it's not really a popular thing that gets published and people have to learn about it before they warm up to it? Are we on the brink of that kind of limitation?
I think that that's one of the most important questions for the time we're living in right now, and it's a question that has been brought up pretty heavily when it comes to Donald Trump and his election and what led to his rise. We're seeing Facebook having to answer for its role in spreading misinformation, its role of not just being a platform where you can post things that you want, but itself being a publisher, itself having ideologies, having interior standards for what's okay to put on a wall or what's okay to put out there for people to see and what's not okay. And when it comes to figures like on the right, like Alex Jones, for example, who've used their platform to spread conspiracy theories and make people believe that, for example, the Sandy Hook shooting was a hoax, we're actually seeing people try to figure out, what does accountability look like here? What was Facebook's role here? Are we supposed to deplatform these people? Are we supposed to, you know, put little disclaimers on top of their content that say this person is known for reporting unreliable things? So that's a huge question that's going to deeply impact every aspect of our lives. I mean, our democracy, our government, our culture. So I think that your anxieties that you mentioned there are very well founded, because it's not just about, like, you know, being able to post something pro-LGBT on my personal Facebook. It's about how me doing that can impact the people around me, how other people seeing that, how it can change their minds. These are tools that we in the LGBT community have historically used to get rights. When we share our stories, when we make ourselves visible, really make a huge impact. And restrictions on that, I mean, it's a really chilling thing to think about, and I think that's why we have to take it super seriously.
Well, I think
exactly.
I'd like to follow up with that. JP, there was an article in The Guardian today. The journalists that have been working as fact checkers for the platform have basically said that the platform's collaboration with outside reporters has produced at best minimal results. They themselves have lost trust in Facebook. Brooke Benkowski, who's a former managing editor of Snopes, told The Guardian, and I'm quoting her, they've essentially used this for crisis PR. Now, my next part of this, besides, you know, dealing with our profession, fake news, and as you put it, you know, the Alex Jones of the world, let me ask you this. I had a friend of mine who's also a source tell me, this person works for a telecommunications company, and they pointed out that the end of net neutrality in a very cynic way, and some of the things that have been publicly said by the, or stated at least by FCC Chairman Ajay Pai, make it sound as though when we see what's going on with limiting LGBTQI people and putting us in a different, you know, almost penned up way, if you will, that net neutrality also plays a factor into it, because at this point now you're talking about, you know, throttling information, throttling data, and, you know, how you allow it to stand up, which would factor also into, and again, keeping in mind that Verizon owns Tumblr now through one of its divisions.
Right.
So, you know, not to sound like a complete cynic here, but I also have to ask that question, and I'd like your opinion. You know, does it look like net neutrality and the end of it is also factoring into this?
Yeah, I mean, I have to assume that it is. I don't know as much of the inner workings of all that as I would like to, but this is something that made me really anxious when it happened, and it sort of blew over, but it's something that we really need to wrestle with, because the internet and the web has been such democratizing factors for us. I mean, most of us come from communities where we've historically not been given a voice, where we've historically not been able to be visible because of our the fear of violence in our immediate surroundings, or the fear of what being visible might bring to us. And we really relied on this tool to get our stories out there and to get what we have right now. And the idea of hierarchies being put in place and us being, I don't know, put into a corner where we can't share in the same way that we've been sharing really frightens me. And I think you're onto something there, that there's an absolute connection.
It just seems to me, JP, that, you know, in the conversations I've had now from your neck of the woods, I've got very dear friends, Toby Jenkins, who runs Quality Oklahoma and the Donald McNeil Center. Mm-hmm. It's also Oklahoma. Toby's an old and dear friend, and F. Scott Hamilton, who's over in Oklahoma City, and some other folks. And so I have a complete empathy and understanding. And Sarah Grossman at Shepherd Foundation and I, of course, talked about this as well. For you guys that are coming out of the flyover red states, this is a dangerous time, because the window literally for the world of LGBTQ and embracing, you know, whether it be a queer identity, a gender identity, or sexual orientation, can get shut down rather rapidly. Not just because, and I'm not, look, I'm not disagreeing that child porn and trafficking isn't an issue or a problem. I'm not saying that. But my fundamental issue with this is it's throttling the ability, okay, for people to be unique, for their individualism, and for their distinctiveness as well as inclusiveness. You know,
yeah.
And it just seems to me that, you know, as we're looking at this, you know, which flips to my next question, one of my acquaintances is now the governor-elect of the state of Colorado. And I would ask the governor, you know, Jared, isn't there something that could be done, even if it's at a local and state level, you know, to mitigate this stuff? Do you think that that's really a good idea? I mean, do we really need – we're obviously not going to get it with this administration, and certainly not with this Senate and this Congress way it's made up. But, well, I'm just saying, I not to be Captain Obvious here, I get that. But what I'm also saying is I think that maybe we should be focused – on these local governments and these state governments to kind of protect the ability for access to the internet and access to sites, so that these queer artists and these trans artists and these queer kids and these trans kids and these, you know, gay and lesbian kids have the ability to not lose their voice. Because I really do, especially for the flyover in the red state area. So I'll get off my soapbox and I'll your time. Go.
We absolutely need to be lobbying for that because it is a community issue that impacts so much else. Like the first example that comes to my mind is that I actually use Tumblr for gay sex ed because in Oklahoma we have abstinence only education. And in like many states where there have been anti-sodomy laws that, I mean, the anti-sodomy laws aren't actively enforced. However, culturally they are, meaning that a lot of these states still have policies of abstinence-only education. They don't talk about LGBT sexuality in schools. They don't teach gay people how to have sex in a healthy way. And I had no idea. I didn't even know what keeping myself healthy or what health even looked like in that area. When I was in high school and I found Tumblr, that's actually how I started connecting to people who were advocates, who were just, you know, sexual gay people who could tell me about how these things worked, what being healthy looked like. It's these community spaces, typically online when you're from flyover country, where people can get resources and information that they can't get from their state governments. I mean, Oklahoma, I mean, we just don't exist.
Yeah, I know.
And so I think we need to start painting the issue in that way as a really urgent community one. And I think that lobbying our local governments is a great idea.
Okay.
Yeah, JP, one of the things that tends to happen on the internet and you know, the kind of, I mean, even before social media, is that these platforms are not invincible ultimately. In other words,
right,
that they can restrict themselves literally out of existence by, you know, a wrong policy, a wrong move, you know, and an upcoming competitor who gets whatever the issue is and then provides the audience with what it is looking for. And there's actually been, I've seen almost a bigger backlash on the Tumblr thing from straight people actually not appreciating the adult content being removed as from the LGBT community. Could this open the door to a new platform that will bill itself as unrestricted and basically take Tumblr down? I mean, or is the legislation that's passed, has that shut the door on that from happening?
Yeah, on a personal, cynical level, if I wasn't even a like community-oriented person, I think it was just a really terrible business move for Tumblr. I mean, something like 22% of their users follow pornographic accounts on there. It's also like a huge part of their ethos, like their entire brand has sort of been built on it. So it's a really boggling thing, and it absolutely opens up doors to competitors. But again, it's sort of like I'm really troubled by what appears to be the media internet landscape right now, which is cracking down across the board on explicit content. So I think something could crop up again if it encounters the same problems that Tumblr did. I worry what they would do to solve it, because, I mean, I guess the question is, are we just living in a time where laws, government, authority, et cetera, is cracking down on what they deem to be explicit content and sort of collapsing these things out of their own existence? I'm not sure. I've already seen a lot of people jump ship from Tumblr to Twitter, though. I mean, Twitter is pretty dirty. I'm like a freak.
Yeah,
I mean, it's already like the meme was that people are already fleeing to Twitter. So I would be interested to see any data on that, like how many people actually made Twitter accounts. But I interviewed one person for my NBC piece on this, an artist who said, well, I just made a Twitter account because my Tumblr account's getting shut down. So I'd be interested to see if they represent a significant number of people.
JP, the thing that, you know, here's the thing that kind of bothers me is that we're talking about expression. We're talking about the expression of individualism. We're talking about the expression of human sexuality. And, you know, of course, the United States, and in, you know, full transparency, even at home in Canada, we have kind of an issue with it. But the Americans in particular are wound a little bit too tight on that subject. And, you know, the thing is, as Sarah, when she was talking with me, pointed out, and I completely agree with this, I think that, you know, if you drive this stuff into a place where no one can get information, there's going to be a domino effect in other areas. We're going to suddenly see a rise in new HIV infections or other forms of sexually transmitted diseases. We're going to see, I think, an uptick in the suicide rate, which is really distressing to me because over the years, I've had to write way too many stories about, you know, LGBTQI kids that have killed themselves.
Yeah.
And we still have a huge problem in the trans community with suicide. So you look at this, and it's just like one thing after the other. It's almost as if someone needs to put their foot down and say, okay, look, we will target specifically and work with developers and engineers to see what we can do about the child porn, because that is a problem. It is something that needs to be addressed. But I think at the same time, there's got to be a safe place because, you know, let's face it, there's too many places, as Sarah and you have pointed out, that exist where the kids don't have a safe place where they can talk. And this was one of the questions I asked Facebook because I see this as problematic. Facebook's implementation of this new policy, you know, I'll be honest, and I was honest with her. I told her, I said, look, you know, no disrespect, but your algorithms suck. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, they're terrible. All right.
Yeah.
What about
there are quite a few.
Go ahead, JP.
Yeah, there's quite a few statistics that go into this that bother me, and I wish I had them off the top of my head, but we do know that LGBT youth tend to find online safe spaces more often than cisgender heterosexual young people do. At much higher rates, they seek them out. We also know that they have higher rates of issues with depression, issues with mental health, issues with feelings of self-worth. But we also know that interactions with community can help mitigate those things. So all those together sort of paint a picture of people who are really benefiting from having an online safe space, from having a place where they can go to escape whatever's going on in the world around them and be themselves, get information, get resources from the internet. And so that was pretty much the first thing that came to my mind when these decisions were announced from Tumblr was that, oh my God, the domino effect is going to be huge on mental health, on how they feel about themselves, on the resources they're getting. It's, yeah, I absolutely agree. It's pretty scary to think about.
JP, I wanted to ask, I've got two teen sons, and do you have any perspective on the generational reach of Tumblr? And I know the answer on Facebook, that it is absolutely losing the younger generation in a huge way. My sons have absolutely, I mean, it's like if you want to say Facebook to them, you might as well say dinosaur. I mean, it's that – that out of touch of what they communicate through, but Snapchat, Instagram, you know, and then they have other platforms that I haven't even heard of that they talk to their friends on. Are those in a similar situation? What do you see on those kind of up and coming sites and those reaches?
Well, yeah, for my generation, it was MySpace that was going out of favor, and we were all getting Facebook, and it was the cool thing when your older friend invited you, because back then you had to be invited to get on Facebook, usually by, like, a college student, so it was, like, this big status symbol. But, yeah, now it's happening to Facebook, and interestingly enough, Tumblr was the place that hosted a lot of young people, especially a lot of young LGBT people. Like, it was just the spot that had art, that had fandoms, people who like TV shows, movies, et cetera, to sort of congregate. And I worry about these young kids going to Twitter, honestly, because Twitter is such a debilitating sort of hellscape.
Oof.
I don't know how they're going to handle it. I don't know. I don't want them to come to Twitter. I know how bad Twitter is. I'm wondering myself, like, what's going to rise to fill the void, because there are other apps that are gaining in popularity among young people. You mentioned Snapchat and Instagram, but the way those places function is different from Tumblr and Facebook, where you are given the space to write things, and you're given the space to put content up that's not purely image-based. One cool thing about Tumblr was that you could, like, I use Tumblr to blog. I wrote, like, long things. I wrote about my feelings. I wrote about my struggles, etc. And connecting on that level was really important to me. And so I have been wondering, where are they going to go? What's next? Is it Instagram? Because I don't know how Instagram is going to facilitate all the things that Tumblr did.
I don't think it can. I think that, and the other question, I actually asked the Facebook executives that question, because they own Instagram. And if they're tightening up and revising community standards on that, you know, principal platform of Facebook, you know full well they're going to do the same thing to Instagram. And Instagram, by the way, already, you know, you'll get yourself, you know, booted or suspended or, you know, put in jail for posting, you know, images or stuff. One of our colleagues, Brad Delaney, who's out of Seattle, JP, you probably saw this. I don't know. The picture of the two human beings standing next to each other, one male, one female, both nipples were visible, but that was it. You couldn't see. And then it only took Facebook, not even 10 minutes to start censoring that thing with the opaque, you know, this image may be sensitive, blah, 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 click to uncover. Brad ran the little experiment. He wanted to see how long it took. And then everybody started sharing it, and within 10, 15 minutes, the algorithm nailed it. Yeah, because there's no way I don't think that, you know, Facebook had that many human beings looking after that particular image.
Right.
But you can't even do that on the Instagram platform. And this, of course, goes to my other point, and you just said it, for some of these people, the joy of gay sex, the joy of lesbian sex, the joy of just enjoying yourself sex, masturbation 101 was Tumblr, or, you know, and now if you're going to take that away, it's just like you're taking away information and you're taking away ability of expression. As my friend Brandon McGill, the artist in Phoenix, said, and this was someone like you who used it as a blog, he used it for his artwork, he used it for expression, you know, and where do you turn? And I agree with you. Twitter is worse than the Wild West. I wouldn't wish that thing on anybody. But I mean, it does beg the question, you know, and this is a concern because, 10 years ago when I took over as DC Bureau Chief of LGBTQ Nation, and that was, and I was there until it was sold to Queerty, I wrote stuff that just, broke my heart. Jamie Rotemeyer in Buffalo, New York. Tyler Clemente in, Jersey. I mean, I've got a list of kids whose parents I'm friends with. You know, Tammy Albert's kid, Justin, up in the Anoka Hennepin School District, and then there were like 8 other kids that also killed themselves. I mean, just this parade of children, And it's like, where can they go? Where do they have this expression? I think, JP, now I have to ask you the tough question. All right, you and I are both journalists. So what do we do? What do we do? What do you do? You're writing for them. I write occasionally for David at New Civil Rights, and I do some other, LGBT publications. But, I mean, what can we do to help? Because this is going to have a really seriously negative impact, especially on queer youth. What can we do?
Yeah, on my end, I've been thinking about that a lot. And what I've been trying to do is really interrogate the reasoning behind these decisions to sort of try to figure out what the larger guiding principles are and ask the people in power, what's going on here, and tell them these are the people that will suffer from this. These are the people who are hurting. These are the people who rely on the services you've been providing. But I think what really sucks for me is that it still doesn't quite feel like enough. I mean, reporting on its own is really important, especially when we can speak truth to power. But I feel like that's where a lot of my abilities begin and end. So I'm really trying to take a more active approach in terms of I write a lot of articles that reach a lot of younger people. Is there a way I can actually provide some of the information that I got from Tumblr in an article? So I'm doing a lot more sex ed pieces. I'm doing a lot more pieces about the laws that are in place that keep sex ed from being taught, inclusive sex ed from being taught, especially in red states. I'm just trying to find out ways we can actually be information hubs until another one comes about.
Pregnant silence, but yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know. JP, and of course, Rob, we've had JP and our mutual friend Zach Ford at Think Progress, the LGBT editor. Zach and I've had this conversation too, and you know, it's just it is a question that I think that we, as journalists, we do need to ask ourselves, because I think it is critically important. And as JP just pointed out, probably even more so for the flyover and the red states. So, Rob?
Yeah, JP, we're coming down to the end of our hour here, and I want to thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights with us. What final words do you have to say on this that we haven't covered so far?
Well, all I can really think to say is that most of us LGBT people do belong to an online community already, and I strongly suggest expanding those circles as much as you can, finding people who might need it and adding it to your circle. I've been doing that a lot lately with my friends, and it's really done wonders for my mental health just to be like, you know, we have a lot of information. Those of us who've been out for a long time and we've met a lot of other people, especially if we're journalists, we do have a lot of valuable things to tell other people. So if you can, try to expand your community in online spaces, especially in this time where it seems to be a crackdown on them.
Very good. Brody, final thoughts from you?
For our listening audience, you can read JP's work at Them Magazine and at NBC and a few other places. He had an excellent piece not long ago. I really, really recommend that you follow him. He's a great journalist, and I'm seriously impressed, and it was nice to meet him. And so, Zach, if you're listening, thank you very much for the intro. I really appreciate it. And JP, I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and this is sort of a question of both of you. What can people who are concerned about this do? Where can they take their concern, anger, angst, and protest?
JP?
I would say the ballot box for sure. That seems
Bingo.
To be, yeah. I mean, that's pretty much my answer for everything these days, but there it is.
Great. All right. Well, I want to thank you both for being on and this really important discussion. I want to thank our listening audience for joining us tonight. We will be back again here next week, same bat time, same bat channel, with another scintillating subject on LGBTQ concerns. Also on Saturday nights, listen to Out in Santa Cruz, and you can hear that on www.ksco.com. That is 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. Again, that's Saturday night on ksco.com. For Brody and myself, JP, I want to thank you very much again for being our guest and our listening audience. I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.